I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. While home cleaning products might get your dishes clean, their ingredients are not necessarily safe. A number of companies have launched to address this concern by making personal care and sanitary products more eco-friendly. My guest, Jeffrey Hollander, is the co-founder of Seventh Generation, one of America's largest distributors of non-toxic household cleaning products.
Whole Foods was growing faster than the industry was growing to support them. You would walk into a Whole Foods store and we would have a whole aisle of Seventh Generation products because they needed to fill up that space. They propelled us. Everyone wanted to look and see what they were doing and understand why they were so successful. And when they looked at the Whole Foods store, they would see, oh my God, there's all this Seventh Generation product. Who are these people? They were the best advertising and marketing we could have had.
Coming up, we'll learn how Jeffrey Hollander has helped to pioneer safe cleaning from scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, co-founder of Seventh Generation, the maker of natural household and personal care products such as unbleached diapers, wipes, dishwashing detergent, and tissues. Jeffrey has been a leading advocate of corporate social responsibility, and he's the author of several books on greener living. Welcome.
Great. Happy to be here.
You grew up in New York City. And you came from a very privileged background. How did you feel about that background?
You know, I had very, very mixed feelings. I mean, I grew up on Park Avenue and went to private schools. And at the same time, was sort of acutely aware of while I had so much, there were many people who had very little. I think particularly as I entered my teenage years and the Vietnam War was going on and there was a huge sort of social questioning that was going on with partially my generation, and people were saying, you know, what's right, what's wrong, what's my responsibility? And as these questions were being asked, I felt like I couldn't explain why I had this very comfortable, privileged lifestyle when so many people didn't have much. I remember going to rallies, probably when I was 15 or 16, going down to Washington, D.C. on a bus to demonstrate in Washington. And in many ways, that experience sort of shaped my life. I grew up both with a strong sense of responsibility that we had to be engaged in the social and political issues of our time, and also the belief that you can actually make a difference because ultimately we had a positive impact on slowing and ultimately ending the war in Vietnam.
What was your parents' response to, you know, you're going to protest in Washington, D.C., and you're going to six private schools? How many private schools did you juggle among?
Oh, probably at least six. I had a dad who was running an ad agency and who was a very conservative businessman. He was Jewish at a time where it was somewhat uncomfortable to be Jewish in the business world. And a mom who was really more bohemian, who was an actress, an artist. And so they both had very different perspectives on my personal orientation, but mostly it was one of indifference. I mean, they were not involved in my life the way I am involved in my three children's life. They would periodically put pressure on me, mostly my dad. When I dropped out of college, he was very distraught. I mean, you know, he sold hot dogs in the sporting arena to pay for his college education. And he felt that I would go into an interview and I would be asked where I went to college and I would be embarrassed by the fact that I had to say I dropped out of college. And I tried to explain to him that I never planned on going on a job interview because I never planned on working for someone else. He also, interestingly, the business I started in Toronto, the Skills Exchange of Toronto, which was an adult education program, was a nonprofit. And he was very upset that I was working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day on a nonprofit. So there were a lot of disconnects. When I sold my second company, which was a books on tape company, to Warner Communications at the age of 29, and he was sitting in the room and got a check for $1 million for his investment, that was a turning point in his attitude about me. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, money is what mattered. And the fact that I had made so much money at an early age sort of meant that I won his approval in a way that nothing else that I had done up to that point did.
Did it matter to you that you had his approval?
Absolutely. You know, it meant a lot to me that not only had I succeeded by my own metrics, but I had succeeded according to his metrics.
You mentioned that you knew you wanted to be an entrepreneur, that you were never going to work for somebody else. Why did you have such a distaste in your mouth for working for other people?
God, I'm not sure that I know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. In part, when you start your own business at such an early age, I never had the experience of having anybody tell me what to do in a work context. So it might simply be that when you start out life as an entrepreneur, it's very hard to go back. You know, to be an entrepreneur, you sort of, not only do you have to provide yourself with your own direction and instruction, but you have to create your own context. And I think it's hard to have someone give that to you when you spent your life creating it for yourself.
You started your first business when you were 14 years old. It was a window washing company in the Hamptons.
Yep.
On Long Island. Talk to me a little bit about that.
West Hampton window washing. It was amazing how much money people would pay to get their windows washed. I mean, people would pay a couple $100 to get their windows washed. My brother and I, who worked at the business together, could do a house or two in a day. And at $200 a pop at 14, 15 years old, that was a lot of money. It took me a long time to make as much money as I was making when I was that young.
So you graduated, or you didn't graduate from Hampshire College. You left to go to California?
Yep. I left school, at the beginning of 12th grade. I had spent a lot of time in California during the summer to go surfing. This is one chapter of a sort of turbulent, confused childhood. But I had left Riverdale to go to Putney School in Vermont. I was there for a year and a half, didn't like it, came back to Riverdale for the second half of 11th grade, and then started Riverdale. I was there for a week or two and came to the conclusion that I wanted to go back to California, and left at the beginning of 12th grade, moved into my car on a cliff overlooking a surf break in Santa Barbara, got myself into Santa Barbara High School, and, you know, spent most of that year in Santa Barbara going to school.
And then when you didn't graduate from Hampshire College, you decided to start an adult education business. How did that happen?
I was reading Ivan Illich's book, and a lot of people don't even know Ivan Illich, but Ivan Illich was a wonderful educational philosopher. In this book called Deschooling Society, he has a chapter on something called skills exchanges, and he has this philosophy that organized, institutionalized education is more about constraining the flow of knowledge than encouraging the flow of knowledge. And he said, you know, knowledge is everywhere. And what he described in these skills exchanges are getting someone like you who knows about, you know, radio production to teach a course in radio production, getting a sushi chef to teach a course on cooking. And his notion was to harness the wisdom of our society and make it available to anyone and everyone who's interested. And the Skills Exchange of Toronto, you know, was not about my passion for any particular educational subject, but about the notion of changing the paradigm that we think about education within, and this marvelous experience of people coming up with all these crazy, wacky ideas for courses, and people sign up, go to someone's house, and have a wonderful experience learning. We had courses, how to lose your Brooklyn accent, what to do when your therapist is away on vacation, the art of flirting, and the most famous of all courses, how to marry money, which became a book and a video and lots of other things. You can tell by the titles of those courses that there was not much focus on solving the problems that were facing society.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, the co-founder of Seventh Generation, a company that produces natural household and personal care products. So we're talking about the early days of prior to launching Seventh Generation, when you launched two adult education businesses. One was the Skills Exchange Toronto, and the next was Network for Learning. What was going on in your personal life at the time? When did you marry your wife, Sheila?
Sheila and I got together sort of at the end of the Network for Learning time, just before I sold the business to Warner Publishing. Like most businesses I've started, that business almost crashed and burned before it succeeded. So she came into my life just as it looked like I was incredibly successful. The whole thing fell apart. I moved the business into my apartment. I moved out of my apartment into her apartment to keep the thing going. And then 2 years later, sold it for a fair amount of money. So she came into my life, I think, sort of confused about what I am. You know, am I successful? Am I not successful? Am I a socially oriented, politically minded person, or am I just a capitalist who wants to make as much money as possible?
But you seem confused about who you were, too, up until you finally acquired this company in 1988 called Renew America, which then later became Seventh Generation. Was that the catalyst for your having more of a focus of what you wanted to be and merging corporate responsibility with profit motive?
Well, after I left Network for Learning, which became Warner Audio Publishing after I sold it, I wrote my first book called How to Make the World a Better Place, a Beginner's Guide. It was really my exploration of, well, what are the opportunities to make the world a better place? What can you do? Coming out of having written that book, I said, you know, I want to have a product that makes a positive contribution to the world, not a product that makes money that allows me to donate some money to a cause. And that was the aspiration behind Seventh Generation.
So Seventh Generation came out of this company that actually had been in bankruptcy called Renew America, which was a mail order catalog company for green products. How did you go about finding this company to take it on?
So when I was writing the book, I came across this Renew America catalog, and I thought, wow, you know, what a cool idea, you know, a catalog that only has good products for the planet. And I love the idea. Little did I know that there weren't a lot of people interested in buying those products. And so by the time the book was done, they were out of business. And they had given the catalog to Alan Newman, who subsequently became my partner. And so Seventh Generation was the sort of rejuvenation and relaunch of that Renew America catalog.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, co-founder of Seventh Generation, a leading brand of natural household products. We'll hear more from Jeffrey coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, co-founder of Seventh Generation, the maker of natural household and personal care products such as unbleached diapers, wipes, dishwashing detergent, and tissues. Jeffrey has been a leading advocate of corporate social responsibility, and he's the author of several books on greener living. Seventh Generation is Iroquois. What does it mean?
Well, it comes from the equivalent of the Iroquois Bible. So the saying is, in our every deliberation, we should consider the impact of our decisions on the next seven generations. Every ad agency that we ever went to in the first decade said that is the worst name you could possibly have. no one is going to understand what it stands for. You know, they said you should be eco something or planet something or green something. And we thankfully stuck with it. And in a way, the name became a fundamental differentiator between us and every other company that was selling green products. The name was a story. The name held emotion in a way that, you know, Bounty or Tide or anything else just will never have.
So you met Alan Newman, who at the time was helping to run Renew America, and he was on board with Seventh Generation for just 4 or 5 years. How come he didn't stay with the company?
Well, we went through one of many disasters. First year, we did $100,000 of business. The second year, we did $1 million of business. The third year, we did $8 million of business. And we expected to do $20 or $30 million the year after. So we hired the people. We rented the space. We bought the inventory. We raised the money to continue what had been relatively spectacular growth. As we went into that fourth year, thinking we were going to do $20 or $30 million, we missed our numbers the first month, and we missed our numbers the second month, and we missed our numbers the third month. And all of a sudden, we knew that our forecast was wrong. We just didn't know how wrong it was. And it was a terrifying feeling because it was like falling without knowing where the bottom was. It was a terrifying, chaotic year in which you become focused on nothing but survival. And you realize that if you don't start cutting your expenses quickly enough, you'll just run out of money. And, you know, I think Alan would tell the story very differently, but there is an incredible excitement of that rapid growth. You know, you're like on a rocket ship that's taking off towards the moon, and the world is your oyster, and everyone thinks you're incredibly smart and you're successful. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're holding on for dear life, and you're wondering whether the business will make it till the end of the year. You know, a lot of people don't like that part of business. A lot of people don't like spending the day negotiating the copy release to try to save money or convincing a vendor to give you another 10 days to pay a bill. And so in that turmoil, a lot of people said, hey, you know, this isn't as fun as it used to be. And so Alan and I parted ways in the midst of that turmoil. I naively said, well, my God, people invested all this money in the business. I've got to find a way to make it work.
Were you glad to see Alan leave?
No, it was a very, very sad and painful situation, I think, for both of us. We had become very close friends. We were partners in the best sense of the word. It was more the stress of the situation that caused us to separate than it was a philosophical difference. You know, at the time, I think he just had enough and he didn't want to deal with it anymore. And he said, you know, I need to take a break.
You talk about investors. Who was invested in the company at the time?
Luckily, I had done very well by the investors who put money into Network for Learning when the company was sold to Warner. So the foundational group of investors were many of the same people. They were more friends and family, much more so than venture investors. So we didn't have people who were clamoring to get inside and tell us what to do. They were pretty much happy to sit back knowing that if anyone was going to save it, we were going to figure out how to save it. It wasn't until, you know, a decade later that we took venture and private equity money. And in between that, we went public. I, after meeting with some venture firms, said, oh, my God, I'd much rather have thousands of little investors than one big investor. So we went public. And, you know, for a small company that was still losing money to go public, I mean, you probably couldn't do it today, but you could do it back in 93. So we had, you know, five, I would say, unsuccessful years as a public company, and at the end of 1999 went back to being a private company.
So it wasn't really until 2000 to 2005 that you really that the business really accelerated.
Yeah, I mean, there's this period of a decade where we were sort of wandering around lost in the forest. And then, you know, from 2000 to 2008, you know, we grew at an average rate of 30% a year. And our stock price went from $1.75 to $22.50. And in 2008, I stepped down as the CEO of the company.
What were some turning points in the business that got you going again?
Yeah. So there were a couple of key turning points. I mean, one was the realization that as important as people say the environment is, what really motivates them are issues of health and safety. And so the tagline for the company was initially products for a healthy planet. We switched the tagline to safer for you and the environment. That was a huge turning point because, you know, as a mom running down the aisle of the supermarket, you're not necessarily thinking about the Amazon rainforest. You're thinking about what is the healthiest product you can buy for your child first. And so that was a big turning point because it affected the products we sold, the way we positioned them, the way we marketed them, the way we designed them. The other biggest turning point was really Whole Foods' success, and Whole Foods was opening up more and more stores. They started opening up bigger and bigger stores, and in this totally bizarre way, I mean, Whole Foods was growing faster than the industry was growing of vendors to support them. So they had these big stores with lots of shelf space, and you would walk into a Whole Foods store, and we would have a whole aisle of seventh-generation products because they needed to fill up that space. They propelled us. Everyone wanted to look and see what they were doing and understand why they were so successful. And when they looked at the Whole Foods store, they would see, oh my God, there's all this seventh generation product. Who are these people? They were the best advertising and marketing we could have had. And they were our entree into other retailers because everyone wanted to emulate what Whole Foods was doing.
It's funny that you were successful at Whole Foods because there was a scarcity of products, so you had this vast real estate on the shelf.
Yeah, I mean, Whole Foods is in many ways responsible for the success of the organic and natural product industry. As they succeeded, more and more people said, oh, well, I want to be in that business and I want to create my own products. And all of a sudden, you know, by 2005, it became almost impossible to get onto the shelves of Whole Foods because there were so many new businesses that wanted to do it. You know, we went through periods of time where there were 20, 30, 40, 50 different companies making natural household products, more than could fit on the shelves of the store.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, the co-founder of Seventh Generation, a company that produces natural household and personal care products. You spent most of your time living in Vermont with your wife, Sheila, and three kids. Why Vermont?
Only because that's where Alan was and that's where the business was. You know, having been born and raised in Manhattan and having moved back, no one in my family had any interest in going to Vermont. But after Alan left the business and I was commuting up there every week, I mean, for 2 years, I got up Monday morning, flew up to Vermont, spent the week there and came back. I had little kids. I wasn't seeing them. I said to my wife, could we please try living in Vermont so we can be together? I said, you know, let's try this for 2 years. If it doesn't work, we'll move back. After a year and a half, we were moving back. No one was particularly happy. And finally, things sort of turned around right before the end of the second year, and we decided to stay there.
So there's a lot going on in your life. Your family moves to Vermont. The business is starting to turn around. And your brother committed suicide at this time. What happened there, and what effect did that have on you?
Yeah, you know, Peter and I had actually worked together Not only was he my brother, he was probably my closest friend and someone that I worked with. And, you know, he suffered, as many people in my family and myself suffer from depression. Back in those days, they were probably a little bit less able to deal with it. A decade ago, I wouldn't have ever said that I suffer from depression because it just wasn't something you talked about. He struggled with that with great difficulty. You know, the other side of the coin is that you know, my wife would say that he lived more life in the 35 or so years or that he was alive than most of us do in a lifetime. I mean, he was the most fun person to be around. He always knew where the right party was. We would go away together. My social life was always dependent upon him. He would always make sure that he met two girls, and I was always happy that I got to go out with one of them, even if it was chronically the less attractive of the two. That was always the case. But he was always larger than life. So it was a turning point in my life. I really had to come to terms with the fact that I had to be in the present and enjoy what I had in the moment because I had no idea what tomorrow or the next moment would bring. And as someone who plans a lot of things and likes to feel in control, I really had to come to terms with the fact that all you have is this particular moment in time. And most of us miss that sense of the present.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, the co-founder of Seventh Generation, a company that produces natural household and personal care products. In 2008, you stepped down as CEO, and in 2010, you were asked to leave the board of Seventh Generation.
Right.
Talk to me about that experience.
Well, you know, when you realize that you don't have control of things, you know, one could take, after being at Seventh Generation for 23 years, you know, to get fired from a company you started could leave you with a very negative, cynical view about life. And, you know, I've had to come to terms with, okay, it's painful, it sucks, I don't like it, but it's also a gift that has freed me to do something else. And I'm not sure that left on my own, I would have gone and done something else. I was very comfortable. The company was doing very well. And yet, you know, I was thrown out of the nest and had to come to terms with, so what do I want to do with the rest of my life? And being forced to ask that question has been a gift. And it has allowed me to say, wow, I don't want to sell any more toilet paper or laundry detergent or diapers. The world is facing much bigger challenges. While the result of that has led me down a path that I'm excited and thrilled about, the experience and the way it happened was miserable and unpleasant. There's no question about that.
You had brought on other investors, other private equity investors at this time who became board members. How was that experience for you?
You always hope that you're bringing on investors that are aligned with your values. They always sound like they're aligned with your values. The truth is, when things are going well, it's easy for everyone to be aligned around the values. 2008, 2009, the business and the economy went through a lot of turmoil, and I began to drift philosophically further and further away from the perspective of the board and particularly the newer investors in the company. That grew to a point of, you know, what I would say were irreconcilable differences. I have a renewed enthusiasm for governance and legality that ensures that alignment when, you know, things aren't going well. And I had many opportunities to do that, and I didn't take the opportunity to formalize the values in a legal framework that would have made those things clear and unquestionable.
What's an example?
A good example is one of the things that made Seventh Generation unique is that we had a salary cap in place where I, as the highest paid person, never made more than 17 times the lowest paid person in the company. In an environment where people on Wall Street and people running large companies are making 500 times the average, let alone the lowest, it was really unusual to say you can grow a successful company, hire the talent you need, and not pay people unconscionable sums that, aside from being unconscionable, make them think that they're a lot more important and a lot more valuable than they are. Now, there was no governance, no legal framework that held that in place. There should have been. And just like Seventh Generation historically gives away 10% of its profits to charitable nonprofit organizations, there's nothing in our governance or legal framework that does that. So all of the parts of the value system, and there's something called B Corporation that is beginning to do some of that. I think that you need to build that into the governance. We have a country where 50% of the country's wealth is held by 1% of the people. And I think that's a dangerous thing for our social fabric, let alone for business.
What now? What are you doing now?
So I am looking to create a financial vehicle that invests in businesses that are committed to creating high-quality, good, permanent jobs, sustainable products, businesses that are driven and served not the interest of an investor, but serve all the other stakeholders that we have to think about, the community, the employees, the environment. We have a huge sector of our economy that is doing that today, but a sector that is not as strong and as vibrant as it could be. And I think that the solution to many of the economic problems we face is ensuring the success and the vibrancy of that part of the economy. The working title is Common Wise Enterprise.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
My guest has been Jeffrey Hollander, co-founder of Seventh Generation. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over four countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota. And so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I had seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability, and there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. The thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding, you know, what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
See, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there was something like 18,000 university graduates of the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had 4 university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had 4 university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother had, was a really great teacher. And so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away.
He died of high blood pressure and hypertension. Basically had a heart attack, yeah.
So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after 4 kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents, and in the afternoons I'd go and meet with her and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today that school is one of the top performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly, and it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA, rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom. Mm-hmm. And then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily I didn't know where my meals were going to come from, where I would get money to buy clothes from, and, you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch, so I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards. Uh-huh. And those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the academy off the ground or to make the idea of the academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. One was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for the campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. You know, does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, you know, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle, and she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in your first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her. And then at the end, she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know. So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money and, you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing, and, you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, mm-hmm. and what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or if they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business
or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And our aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time, in real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18, running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back at a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we like, that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy.
If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.